Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Latin American Studies. My name is Piotr Krasicki. I'm a history professor at the University of Maryland in College Park. Our guest today is Margarita Fajardo. She's a professor at Sarah Lawrence College and historian of modern Latin America and of economic ideas and economic life. She received her PhD from Princeton University and her BA from Universidad de los Andes in Bogota, Colombia. She has written numerous articles on the history of international development, the global social sciences, and the history of capitalism in Latin America and beyond. And the focus of our conversation today will be her brilliant new book, just out this year, 2022, with Harvard University Press, The World That Latin America Created, the United Nations Economic Commission for Latin America in the Development Era. Welcome to the program, Margarita.
Thank you so much for having me. This is very exciting to be able to talk about this book and hopefully many more things that it inspires and not just the book itself.
I'm sure of it. This is absolutely one of the most stimulating books I've read in the past year, to say the least, probably longer than that. And I'm just going to open with the kind of question that I ask all of my guests at the start, but I'm going to add a little twist on it, which is for those in our audience who've never heard of CEPAL, if you could maybe just say a few words, what is it, and why did you choose to write a book about it?
Yeah, so CEPAL is the acronym in Spanish and Portuguese for an institution, a UN institution, a United Nations institution called the United Nations Economic Commission for Latin America. The institution was established in 1948, with headquarters in Santiago, Chile, and is still live and lively institution to this day. I focus on CEPAL, or more precisely, the book is more than about CEPAL, it's about CEPALinos, but we can talk about that a little later. But why write a book about CEPAL, as you asked? I think there's the main reason was that CEPAL, well, there were two sort of reasons. One was that CEPAL seemed to be like appear everywhere on the Latin American history as this crucial institution that was the ideological foundation of the development program or project that of 20th century Latin America. So it seemed pretty important. And yet it was sort of like nowhere really, because there was no sort of, we had like compilation of texts and a lot of information about the ideas that kind of emerged within the context of the institution, but there was no real traces of the individuals, of the problems, of the projects behind them. So I was sort of drawn to that sort of kind of quality to it, that it appeared to be very important, and yet it was really nowhere to be kind of grasped. And the other thing that was sort of motivating me was that I was beginning grad school in just after the financial crisis, I guess, I was interested in working on economic ideas and economic policies and economic life. And there was a lot of like growing interest in my field, but also in all in history fields, in history of capitalism and history of economics and economic ideas. But all of those seem to kind of point to ideas coming from either the North Atlantic, really. And so I was sort of thinking, well, how can we have this sort of very important institution that is recognized as such, but all that we talk about her economies that are influential are these other types of economies. So I was kind of trying to feel that urge to kind of understand why, first, what was CEPAL, right? And then why didn't it appear? Why did it appear so marginal in sort of all these stories? So that was sort of the motivation behind this book.
Well, it's clear as one reads the book that CEPAL was many things and spawned many things. But you brought up early in the first sentence of your answer to my question that it's about CEPALinos, your book. And I'm really glad you said that because I wanted to ask what it took or what it meant to be a CEPALino. And is that a historically contingent term? In other words, very specific, or the sort of identification changed over the time period that you talk about in the book? The book's obviously, and you say this as much in the introduction, at least in part, a collective intellectual biography. So you're writing the history of the CEPALinos, but did that just mean folks who played leading roles in CEPAL, or a kind of broader orbit?
Yeah. So who are the CEPALinos, and who do I classify within that term, I guess, is sort of the question. So I think that there are two things that for me helped unify that unify who I think CEPALinos are. First, I think it has to do with their understanding or their they have a shared concept of the world economy, the one that is kind of the notion that is sort of summed up in the concept of center and periphery. And they have that as some sort of shared idea that binds them together. That idea sort of takes them to very different places, as I trace in the book. But I think that is one of the fundamental things. And they are part of this initial cohort of leading people at CEPAL. CEPAL came to be a very big organization. It wasn't as such in the beginning. It was a kind of a small group. And that's where I'm sort of trying to do the that's how I identify them. But there's no, I don't think I ever used like some, I like the quote, or let me just go back. I like how one of these CEPALinos sort of tells his story of what CEPALinos are. And he says, like, you know, I thought I was a Marxist, then I thought I was a Keynesian, and then I realized I was a CEPALino. So it was something that they kind of came to be, let's say, like an identity and sort of a more than an identity, like a collective project that came to be throughout the years. And that also changed throughout the years. And as I trace in the book, there's some sort of crucial turning points in the story that have to do, for instance, with their participation in the Alliance for Progress or the Cuban Revolution. But I'll keep it at that. I don't for now.
Yeah, thank you. So the ideas that you mentioned, you know, it struck me, especially early on in the book, there is a lot of attention or studies, and for clear reasons, in some of these cases, the CEPALinos did their studies in Europe, in other cases, did their studies in the US. And it really grabbed my attention early on, this idea of Keynesianism being at the heart of early CEPALino orthodoxy. And when you talk about Keynesianism and also the Marshall Plan, I found this to be a really fascinating conversation early on in your story. To what extent was Western Europe, especially in this post-World War II moment, a serious model or a serious conversation piece in terms of regional coordination and regional integration. So I ask that kind of on its own terms, but also by way of saying it's wonderful how the quotation you just brought out said, well, I came kind of from Marx and kind of from Keynes, but really I'm a Cepalino. And I wanted just to put a finer point on it, if you don't mind. Did the European legacy matter, and to what extent?
I'll answer that question in a bit, but let me go back to sort of some of the thinking of who are Cepalinos giving this ideas that we're bringing up about schools of economic thought. So I guess for a long time, we sort of understood Cepalino ideas as sort of one school of economic thought. But I think one thing that is interesting for our listeners to understand about Cepal and Cepalinos is that they are not they're not university professors, they're not academics, really. They do have some formal studies in economics, some even have PhDs, but not most. That's sort of more the exception than the rule. And so they're not what you would think when, like, their story is not a story of what you would think, well, I'm going to tell you a story of a bunch of economists. Because that's why I sort of, in a point in time in the evolution of the writing of the book, I sort of switched to talking about them, about like Cepal economists or the economists of Cepal, to kind of just say about Cepalinos, because there was something that they themselves identified as different and not that had nothing, or not nothing to do, but it was not necessarily related to their specific academic training in one or on another institution. And so that's sort of something to kind of remember, to kind of give a fuller sense of who they are. The question of Europe, and I talk about a lot in the book as the as Europe, not necessarily as a model for them, but as a reference, let's say, and in the sense that sometimes, like, we think about the European integration process as sort of leading the way for other European integration with other regional integration processes. And what I wanted to show in the book as well is how much these, like, other processes, like the one going on in Latin America, were almost going simultaneously. And the the Cepalinos were rightly so thinking about, like, how did the process come about in Europe and the role of the Marshall Plan in making that possible. And hence they were all at many points sort of thinking about, like, well, that was a fundamental asset for European integration that they were looking to convey the importance of to make the Latin American integration possible. I wish sometimes, like, I could have done more on the reverse relationship, like, where Europeans looking at the Latin American integration process. I had to limit my research at some point, but I think that's an interesting question that could be that needs a little bit more research.
Thank you so much. I wanted to push in on a couple of individuals, and there's one in particular with whom I wanted to start, because, of course, as in any good global transnational history, your book has a lot of back and forth between the national and the international stages. And the book wouldn't exist without the national stories. And I think you're quite clear about that, and you do a brilliant job of showing the interplay and making sense of it. It strikes me, though, of course, you in the introduction talk about Chile, Argentina, and Brazil. But as I read the book, I felt like you really liked the Brazilians. And liked is maybe a kind of a facile word here. But even folks for whom things didn't work out so well, like Celso Furtado, it felt like you appreciated what he was trying to do. So I'm going to ask maybe a kind of an emotive question here, but, you know, what drew you to the Brazilians? And is that a certain something about Brazil and its contingent historical moment, or is it about the people, specifically the individuals themselves?
I mean, that is interesting question. I guess there's two. I don't think I necessarily particularly like the Brazilians, but let me talk about why the book, I guess, hinges so much on Brazil. The book is centered on the exchange, the transnational exchange between Chileans and Brazilians, and between the sort of co-observation, or like the observation that Brazilians were doing of Chile and Chileans of Brazil, and how that shaped their ideas about what should be done in one country or the other, and what Latin America was, and their economic problems were as well. So that's why I think I try to sort of do a relatively equal weight to Brazil and Chile, and to show, I guess there's many points in the book in which I show the importance of each of those national contexts for transforming the ideas, for instance, with regards to inflation or with regards to dependency theory, in which both the exchange between these two countries and the Chilean and the Cepalino and Chilean the Chilean and Brazilian Cepalinos sort of mattered to kind of understand what they were. So that's sort of the bigger picture of your question. But Celso Furtado is a very prominent figure in the story of Cepal, and that's why he appears very, very in that place. I think a lot of the, you know, we often talk about the leader of Cepalinos is Raúl Prebisch, an Argentinian, much senior to the rest of the cohort of Cepalinos that he's working with. And I think sometimes, although the role of Furtado is obviously like recognized, in general, in sort of producing the ideas that we now recognize as Cepalino ideas, Furtado also played a role, I think a major role in disseminating the ideas in Brazil, which was necessary partner to be, like, I guess to kind of conquer as part of this project, to get it on board, let's say, and diffuse the ideas of and project Cepalino ideas. So I think that's why he appears so prominently. I was fascinated by him because of the role that he did, not just in his intellectual role in terms of producing ideas, but the type of networks that he created and the type of institutions that he created to give this idea some solid foundation. So let me say a little bit more about then why Brazil sort of matters so much too, because I think that those kind of institutional networks that he created and have allowed for a persistence of developmentalism in Brazil that is in many ways unique in the context of Latin America. So that would be sort of my answer a bit of it, but we can talk about my Furtado specifically if you want.
Well, for me, he's part of a mosaic, and I'm glad you brought up Raúl Prebisch also. Prebisch and Furtado both achieved or held at various points very prominent public offices. And this is something that's striking for me, right? Also, as I read your book, there's an interplay between maybe academics is the wrong word, or the let's say Cepalinos who had one foot in academia, one foot not, and then Cepalinos who really wanted to get into positions of state power in order to do stuff. Not that they were power hungry, but that they had concepts. And Furtado was certainly one of the leaders among them. I guess the reason I brought him up too, and this maybe can help frame my next question, is that he really tried very hard to make the Alliance for Progress work. And it struck me in your reading of Furtado that you were appreciative of him while uncompromisingly scathing when it came to the Alliance for Progress. So if you want to talk more about Furtado, great, please go ahead. I wanted to ask you maybe to say a few words about the Alliance for Progress as a turning point in your story. And, you know, obviously it coexists in this universe temporally with the Cuban Revolution and what Cepal was doing there. But without complicating things unnecessarily, why was the Alliance for Progress such a disaster? And, you know, why did it almost ruin Furtado's career?
I can talk about, like, and in the book I sort of call it the twin events of the Alliance for Progress, the Cuban Revolution and the Alliance for Progress, because it is sort of the combination of these two things that really shifts Cepal's trajectory. But before, I mean, to explain the shift, I guess I have to tell you a little bit about what was Cepal's trajectory up to that point. So I think the first two chapters in the book deal with the construction of the Cepalino project and how they try to assert their position and their authority in the sort of regional sphere, but also in the global sphere, because they're like, the way I kind of imagine their world is a competition, and that's what I try to show also in the book, like a competition of different ideas and ideologies and policies, and they need to assert their own in their and what is their territory and what is their sphere of influence. And so the first two chapters are sort of trying to lay that out, like lay what the project is about. And it's a development project that is trying to transform the world economy by the economic transformation of Latin America. And their project is about solving what I call the development paradox. That is the idea that to solve the dependence on trade of Latin America and or other regions on the periphery of the world economy that produce so much raw materials and primary products for the industrial centers, that there's dependence on trade needs sort of, to solve it needs more and better terms of trade, literally, let's say, but also better arrangements of trade, to kind of say, be a little bit more broadly. So the Cepalinos for a long time are trying to do these two things, right? Like develop what are the suggestions and what are the ideas and policies to kind of solve this development paradox, some of which involve the cooperations with the industrial centers and some of which involve the demanding like that hegemonic power sort of fulfill their role as hegemons and do a variety of different things, like for instance avoid protectionism and leave the markets open for their goods, among others. So in these two, I try to trace that ascent and that attempt to kind of establish their authority. So by the point we get to sort of the Alliance for Progress and the Cuban Revolution, I think Cepalinos have achieved a lot of victories and successes in terms of establishing that authority, some of which I talk a little bit in the, or one that I particularly like because it exemplifies that sort of ascent, is their sort of competition with the IMF. And how they are able to situate themselves kind of in a way, these winners in the battle of ideas in that moment. So it's at this moment that when they have sort of established themselves, that the Alliance for Progress and like the Cuban Revolution and the Alliance for Progress as the U.S. response to the Cuban Revolution come about. And I think it challenges them in many different ways, because these two projects that are supposed to be kind of on the opposite ends of the political and ideological spectrum at this moment in sort of Latin American and global history, divide Cepalinos. Like some Cepalinos think that the Alliance for Progress is the mechanism that will make their project be materialized, in part to go back to kind of your first question of the Marshall Plan, because it seems to be that that is the Marshall Plan for Latin America. It sort of finally comes into being. And so so that's sort of one reason. But there are some other Cepalinos that think that is the Cuban Revolution that is going to kind of really represents their way to make the project real. And so these, there are different, I don't want to delve too much, but there are different like individual experiences with both, some of which was Furtado, as you mentioned, that was pretty much devoted to making it happen and felt very much disappointed that instead his project was sort of taken over by the Alliance for Progress officials. But I'll leave it at that in case you want to talk a little bit more about that in some other way.
Well, the twin events that you were describing, I think that the overlap chronologically, and you know, I have having this experience reading your book where I was thinking to myself, to what extent does the U.S. really matter here? Well, one can't escape the U.S., and not least because the Alliance for Progress was a U.S. initiative. The Marshall Plan, even if it's just a historical point of reference by the late 1950s, early 60s, was also a U.S. initiative. And there are moral and cultural valences to that, aside from the actual planning that went into it. But I did actually want to talk a little bit more about Cuba specifically. There's one thing that you said toward the end of your the chapter about revolution, which really struck me, and it had to do with the fact that Cepalinos. So Prebisch agreed initially to start a mission in revolutionary Cuba, and then pulled the plug on the mission. And you said, sorry, I'm not going to quote you anymore, but this one really struck me, that meant that the Cepalinos could no longer claim to speak to and from Latin America. And I think that maybe was one of the most striking sentences in the entire book for me, because of the contrast between this U.S.-driven initiative, Alliance for Progress, and okay, we can and should say all kinds of things about the Cuban Revolution, but this... I guess I read it as a kind of a betrayal or an unwillingness to see out the process of CEPAL's involvement. I wanted to ask you, do I read that correctly? And also, if you could maybe say a little bit more, because for me it was very striking to say Prebisch pulled the plug, he didn't want to taint CEPAL or taint it anymore, and for CEPAL, that was it. They weren't Latin American anymore.
Well, I think that I wanted to say is that they couldn't kind of claim to represent the whole region, right? They were breaking off from, at least institutionally, right? This is not the case of many individual Cepalinos who were, in fact, even growing even more committed to the Cuban Revolution after the institutional break away, let's say, from the revolution. So I do think that made a substantial it's had a substantial impact in how many, especially in the intellectual left, saw CEPAL. Like, was it really that source of like very interesting radical ideas about what the world economy was and how it could be transformed and what the place of Latin America in that world economy was and should be. And so for many, I think that was sort of interpreted. Of course, this cannot be generalized because there were many in Latin America, obviously there were many sort of governments that even though they were protecting or defending Cuba's kind of self-determination, like the right to create its own path, they didn't necessarily like the way it had taken. So many were actually like at some point supported Prebisch, right, for making that stand and making clear that that was not the way they, whatever, quote unquote, acceptable way. But I think that really created a fissure among Cepalinos and also between Cepalinos and the sort of its broader and their broader sort of milieu.
Thank you. I mean, this for me is, I think, maybe that crossroads moment. And I mean, you say more or less exactly that in the book, where we start migrating from Cepalinos to Dependentistas. And of course, I was struggling with the metaphor to think about. I don't know if you'd think about it as a Venn diagram. A subset is completely wrong, but clearly there's a relationship that I think it would be helpful to visualize. But by the same token, what makes it tricky to visualize, as you describe beautifully in your narrative, is that that relationship evolves. And it's a dynamic process. But I did want to ask about the relationship of the, let's call it, IMF critical, or anti-IMF is too strong, maybe IMF skeptical trends within CEPAL in the mid to late 1950s, whatever was left of those by that point, and this idea of structural solutions needed for the inflation problem, and the opening to socialist revolution. Because I think one of the themes that really struck me, the differences between the first half and the second half of your book, is that in the first half, Prebisch, Furtado, they have their politics, but often they did what they thought they needed to do in order to try to get things done. And there's this notion of nonpartisanship. That notion evaporates in the second half of your book. And partisanship isn't necessarily right, but there's a politics to dependency theory. And I'm just curious if you feel like the structural approach to inflation was ultimately at the heart of the birth of that political valence of dependency theory? Or, I don't want to make this sound like a path dependency. Are we talking about two different things here?
Let me say a couple of things to orient us, I guess. So, so first, what is the relationship between Cepalinos and Dependentistas that you asked in the beginning? So I started using the word like they're both their allies and their critics. But I see Dependentistas are both allies and critics of Cepalinos. But Dependentistas are sort of a new generation, not necessarily like a new intellectual generation, that emerges out of both standing on the shoulders of Cepalino and Díaz, but also distancing from what Cepal is and represents, especially in relation to what we were just talking about, the twin events of the Alliance for Progress and the Cuban Revolution. And so Dependentistas sort of emerge out of those moments of in which Cepal is sort of not necessarily weakening, but is at a crossroads, right? What is the next step for this project that has now been challenged from these two major international and I guess regional events? Just before, like in the book, this is sort of something that I had to struggle with, because like the chapters are obviously organized analytically and in certain topics, but really like the first like the half of the chapters are occurring at the same time. There, all these events are sort of intermingled. So the Alliance for Progress and the Cuban Revolution, the debates about inflation and what to do with it, and sort of the structural solutions that you were alluding to, they're all happening at the same time, even though I sort of separated them and analytically into two chapters. And I think, I don't know if necessarily like there is necessarily a direct relationship, let's say, between the debates about inflation and the birth of the Cepalino approach to inflation, or the structural approach to inflation, and what comes later and what the Dependentistas see on Cepal. There is not a direct relationship in terms of like the genealogy of ideas, let's say. But there is a relationship in terms of what is the political standing of CEPAL. So I think dependentistas are confronted with a CEPAL that has sort of, in a way, two faces. Like on the one hand, it has adopted a very different stand to the IMF, right? It has said like, okay, the policies that the IMF is recommending to deal with the inflation problems that are affecting our countries are not necessarily the best ones that that we consider. There are many, like the Cepalinos, for instance, thought that inflation was sort of a result of the process of development, and therefore had, in a way, had there was some tolerance that policymakers and institutions and global governments institutions have to have with inflation because it was sort of part or as a result of the development process. And only by solving sort of one of those development paradoxes and other problems, such as the agricultural productions, for instance, in the case of Chile, could inflation that be resolved. So on the one hand, there was this CEPAL that was seen to be very, you know, to say the least, skeptical of the, as you said, of the IMF position. But on the other hand, we have a CEPAL that has some Cepalinos that are very much aligned with the Alliance for Progress and the U.S. project of development for Latin America. So that I think that crossroads or that context in which CEPAL has this possibility of going in very different ways is what creates the sort of reflection about Cepalino ideas that will eventually lead to dependency. So it's like a kind of assessment, and we should remember a bit, and this is why you said like it's hard to draw the lines and do you need a Venn diagram or not, because some of these Cepalinos eventually sort of turn dependentistas, right? But I sort of also try to distinguish them analytically to show the evolution of their ideas, and especially to show, as you said, I spend a lot of time in the book discussing the politics of dependency theory, like how much was at stake in very small definitions of what this theory was and what it meant, and how much was at stake in the early 1960s when it emerged in Brazil, and how much was at stake later on in the late 1960s in Chile when it consolidated as this sort of more kind of intellectual force with global repercussions.
Thank you. I mean, that was a marvelous synthesis of how the book it coheres, and I think the argument really, you distilled it just marvelously for the readers. Readers, make sure you buy the book. Margarita didn't tell you everything, I promise.
But
I'm going to actually take up the last thing you said about the political options that were available, in part because I found. I mean, I should be clear about my own prejudices here for a second. I am, among others, a historian of global Catholicism, and I'm very interested in Christian democracy. So, you know, whenever you would talk about Eduardo Frei, I would mark him up with an asterisk. And of course, Frei does play a role in at least the first half of this story. But then again, even if we're talking about, let's say, the more left-leaning side, and left and right aren't exactly fair terms when we're talking about Christian democracy, but the Christian Democrats in different Latin American countries were very different from one another. So it strikes me, even that photo you have early in the book where Frei and Salvador Allende are together smoking cigars in 1944, I think it was. That is a really striking thing to see, given what I know of what happened later, of how, you know, after Allende's death and the coup, Frei basically helped to legitimate the Pinochet regime. But in between sort of trying to propel maybe CEPAL to a more visible place. Obviously, it was Santiago, it was his country, so Frei cared what was going on and what they were thinking. And sort of really shifting in terms of his position in terms of the 70s after his presidency. There was a Christian Democratic presidency in the country that hosted CEPAL. So This may not be about religion at all, but I'm just curious, given that left and right, military dictatorship and Marxist revolution are framing parts of your overall narrative, do the Christian Democrats deserve ideologically or maybe in terms of political economy, which is pretty important to Christian Democratic policies, some kind of stake in the story, or were they just kind of blowing with the wind?
No, I mean, I don't think they're, I think they do deserve and they have a place in the story. There's a threat that comes from this story of Frey and some of the Christian Democratic projects that I am interested in following and starting to follow, with a project that didn't make it to the book, but I'm starting to work on, which is the Andean Market. So just that emerges in the Christian Democratic government of Eduardo Frei. So I'm doing that more, and doesn't show up in the book. But what I would say of what it means that Cepalinos had these conversations or were part of the circles of all these Chileans, but also Brazilians, and also sort of, you know, Venezuelans or Colombians that belong to sort of very different ideological stripes, let's say, or that eventually kind of, as you say, like kind of are going to belong to sort of different ideological and political affiliations. I think that to me, that means two things. So one thing is that sort of it also shows that the kind of educated elite that these Cepalinos were part of, right? Like there's a small circle of people who are part of this educated elite who have access to this sort of social context in which some of these ideas develop, right? Like these exchanges in like somebody's house or that is very common among these networks. And I guess any other network, right? It's just not happening in the text or discussions and reports, but it's also happening in these social settings. And so I would say that that points to that. And the second thing, which is also something that I try to show in the book, is to what extent, and also relates to the point of the relationship between Alliance for Progress and Cuba, is to what extent Cepalinos had sort of become the center of a kind of a regional consensus, that they had become this sort of reference of hegemonic ideas, to kind of go back to some of the things that I said in the beginning. How had they established themselves as some sort of key reference point for the political elite in the region and the policymaking elite? So so I think that that's what I wanted to show with all of them, that even if you like them or not, or if you were their friends or their allies, you were kind of forced to kind of take them into account, let's say. And so that to me was sort of crucial, and that's sort of the role of Frey. But I must say that Frey used to occupy a lot of space, and his government used to occupy a lot of space in the book in previous iterations. I had to sort of get rid of that to kind of make it more sort of coherent. But it does appear as some of the context in which, for instance, the book Dependency and Development, a classic of dependency theory, is written. That is the moment that it appears, and I don't think it's sort of non-coincidental that is sort of one is considered kind of a more or a less radical version of dependency theory, that it emerges in like this sort of less radical government of Chile in relation to what's going to come next when Allende and socialism become the dominant project.
Well, so actually this is exactly where I was hoping to go next. Let's talk about Allende and Pinochet also for a minute. I should step back for a minute and say, obviously, coups and revolutions frame the entirety of the story, right? I mean, whether we're talking about Prebisch struggling with Peronism or about how the Brazilian military dictatorship transformed Furtado's career, and also, you know, all the young generation, the dependentistas, of course, that's how they ended up in Chile and spread elsewhere across the region. So when it comes to the early 70s, on the one hand, Santiago reads in the last chapter of your book like the coolest place in the world, I have to say. No, I'm serious. I really enjoyed reading that chapter. It's vibrant. It's a global crossroads. And we see that when you bring in Samir Amin and the emergence of the World Systems Crew. It's really fascinating place intellectually. And of course, that is completely decapitated with the coup. So if I could just encourage you to zoom in for a second on that moment for the purposes of the audience and sort of, tell us what do you think that contrast and that sort of shock of going from the most vibrant to, I don't want to say the most repressive, because that might not be a fair judgment, but pretty repressive, especially given what had existed just before, meant for all the players in your book.
Well, yeah, that's it's a big topic. Let me just go back a little bit to when you said, like, how much the coups and revolutions and these military takeovers are shaping the story. I guess I wanted one of the main goals of this book was to make these ideas be ingrained in their context and show how much of these politics that we think of, whether we want to, right and left or capitalism and socialism, had an impact, obviously, on the way Cepalino ideas developed, but also how much Cepalinos were sort of affecting those kind of alignments, let's say, those sort of coordinates, to call it. So a lot of that is why they appear kind of so prominently, because I wanted to show sort of their politics of their expertise, and that's what's driving them. And Santiago, as you say, like Santiago in the 70s is just one of those very vibrant examples of precisely the politics of this expertise. So what I see happening in the 70s is in Santiago is that, and really the late 60s and up to the early 70s, a lot of the Brazilians who had been thinking about dependency ideas, who had developed ideas about dependency in very specific regional or local centers within Brazil, be it Sao Paulo or Rio or more concretely Sao Paulo and Brasilia, sort of migrated to Brazil and in part escaping the military coup that had happened in 1964. And then they found themselves in Chile and others for other reasons. For instance, Gunter Frank was not living in Brazil at the time, but he also comes to Chile sort of at this moment. And what I think Chile creates is what they find in Chile is a very politicized environment, and how their ideas, what I want to try to show, their dependentista sort of kind of fuel that politicization even more. There's a lot of divisions that among the dependentistas that I trace precisely because of these different political alignments that are going to transform what the theory looks like and what it and how it is read across the world. So the politics of the 1970s Chile is going to become sort of crucial to understand how dependency was read and how it and how it migrated outwards from Santiago. And I guess in stark contrast to what happens after the 1973 military coup and the assassination of Allende, does feel like there's a retrenchment from this very active political milieu. But there's also something that I see happening a lot of these intellectuals in this context of dismay and terror and uncertainty, that they're also sort of reflecting of what was the role of intellectuals then and what should be the role of intellectuals in this sort of new era. And I think those are very interesting questions that I'm sort of hoping to kind of follow as well, you know, what happens to and how do these, as you were saying, this very vibrant, radical area sort of transforms, and doesn't it transform into something completely different? But we do, there are still traces of that, but it's important. I think that's something I'm interested in working and kind of following up more. I don't know if I answered the question or give it like as vivid an image as I did on the book. But maybe that's good. So people go.
Well, of course. One of the goals here will remain, and I'll remind everyone at the end that we want folks to go out and get the book and read it, because it's really marvelous read in addition to being such a major intervention. I want to take up the question you posed just now that you said you want to continue following about intellectuals and maybe ask a methodological question. But I mean, it's connected to the content too. I've found there to be really some pretty interesting work in recent years in the global history of economic thought. And it strikes me that your book, I'm still not sure I have the right noun. Corrective is probably not it, because I don't want to take anyone else down, but the perspective is new for me. And I say this as someone trained in a different field, but who's really actively following how different fields entangle with one another. And economic thought is clearly one of the places where, quote unquote, it's at right now. And intellectual history really strikes me as a powerful tool for looking at the emergence and transformation of global institutions. So I want to ask you maybe a twofold question about this. One is, if you feel like the kind of sources you were able to get to and the kind of story that you wanted to tell really demanded intellectual history, really... can you imagine telling the story of CEPAL and the legacies it had for global economic thought without a lot of intellectual history? And then second, you know, where you think of that particular method as you've employed it, joining a wider conversation. I'm thinking here, for example, of Quinn Slobodian's book from 2018 about the book Globalists, about the neoliberals, which, you know, starts in Habsburg Vienna and ends up also talking about the new international economic order at the end of the book. So I will leave that to you.
Yeah, there's like kind of three questions on this question. So let me see if I can sort of answer them. So first, the kind of talk about the type of intellectual history that I was doing and how it helps us trace institutional histories. I think we're in a very broadly speaking, the field is in a very interesting place of opening up all these institutions that had remained closed. We sort of had an idea of the. And I like this. I use this quote from Hirschman a lot because it's a very useful one, that these institutions like the IMF or the World Bank or in my particular case of CEPAL had personalities. And we sort of know what they are and what they meant and what is the role that they're to play in the world. We all, you know, we sort of had figured that out already. We're just showing how it happened. And I think that we're in a very interesting moment of sort of, as I was saying, sort of opening up those institutions and one of those, and intellectual history does provide a possibility. I think intellectual history, obviously, like broadly understood, right? Like not understood as a history of ideas contained in the text, but very much trying to think about the relationship between the content and the context and understanding the places from which people are enunciating their political ambitions and what is also not said or what is implicit in many of these conversations that are actually shaping these ideas. So I think that is very... That is definitely like, I think that my book is sort of part of that. And I see more of that coming up now, like not the stuff that has been published, but I see works that are in the works and that are going to come up and going to absolutely help with that project. I also think that for me, for instance, for my particular project, the use, because I didn't have a CEPAL archive, there was a few pieces of documents of CEPAL at the UN in New York and at the UN in Geneva and a few extra at the UN in Santiago, but there was no actual sort of institutional archive. The institutional archives of these other institutions, like the IMF, or especially the IMF, although I used a little bit the World Bank, it helped me recreate this story and understand how much ideas matter for these institutions. Some of these institutions and international governments, we were looking at it maybe before sort of this kind of scholarly generation as plain the expressions of interests. And I think most of us, or a lot of people who are working on this, are trying to understand them just beyond that, beyond representing the geopolitical interest of certain nations and actually sort of taking the ideas of the bureaucrats and all the members of this institution sort of seriously. So I would say about that to kind of your first two questions. And sort of the other latter question about, you know, how is this book kind of compared to sort of other histories of like international governance? I think there's two ways in which I sort of tried to make it an intervention. First, in showing how much something that I begin to talk in the beginning, or something that I talked to about in the beginning, how much of these ideas sort of represent how much the power of these ideas in the region and the world in a sort of global context in which we think that, you know, the powerful ideas are those that are, or the ideas that have power, let's say, that have influence, that manage to shape things, are the ones that are coming from the global north. And that is something that we still see in many of the works on international governance. They're very much not only sort of implicit in their narrative, if you read who the actors are, where the agency is located, even when they're talking about like other regions in sort of the global south, the agency is not there. And that's what I really try to do with this book, not just in terms of the argument, like to say what I was saying, but also how I was saying. So I try to emphasize, and this implied after a point that I sort of discovered this, implied a major rewriting to kind of shift the narrative and make the not just the what I was saying, but the how I was saying it matter in the book. So those, I would leave it at that.
Well, I think that's a real model to follow in the sense, and you're quite clear about this, you know, in the epilogue, you sort of go into the role that your actors and your story play in the creation of the field of Latin American studies, among other fields. But by the same token, the book is global history as well as Latin American history. And you're very emphatic about that. And personally, I like that. But I also think that, you know, it's a serious methodological question. How do you present yourself as having the bona fides simultaneously to intervene in parallel in the two fields?
Yeah. Well, that is certainly a risk I took. But I think I will defend that, you know, that sort of methodological choice, because, you know, I don't think global history by global history, we need to do sort of like exhaustive, right? Like it's impossible to do it. But I did want to show like first the impact of so many different global, I guess, processes and questions that were beginning with the, just the mere concept of what international development was and the impact that this this group of the Cepalinos independentistas had in the world. But yeah, I mean, I think it is, you know, I think I would leave, you know, let the readers to sort of make the final assessment of whether I was able to pull that off.
Well, I'm sad to say that it's time for us to come to the last question. So as I always do in my podcasts, I finish by just asking What are you working on now?
I am working a lot on promoting this book, but I'm doing for a new project is something that I've sort of tentatively titled Development as Vocation, Latin America in the Neoliberal Era. So I'm sort of trying to understand the legacies and continuities of development in an era that sort of declared them defunct. And a lot of this has to do with tracing kind of some of them are loose threads, as I was saying before, that came from this project, but that had very different repercussions and very different set of actors than the ones that I talked about in this book. So I feel like at this point in my kind of trajectory, this is just the opening scene that I hope will lead to something different. But at least, you know, you have to begin somewhere. And this is where I'm beginning.
Well, it sounds wonderful. I can't wait to see where the trajectory takes you. And let me just remind everyone once again that we've been talking about a book entitled The World That Latin America Created, the United Nations Economic Commission for Latin America in the Development Era, published by Harvard University Press this year, 2022. Our guest has been Margarita Vajato, professor from Sarah Lawrence College. Margarita, thank you so much for doing this.
No, thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you very much for this conversation, allowing me to touch upon so many different topics. I hope, hope to come back here again in 10 years or so.
I know that the listeners, as well as certainly I, were looking forward to it. Thanks to everyone for listening, and wishing you all a good day.